The Nationals walking away from the net zero target, dialing up pressure on Liberal leader Susan Lee, while the government tries to speed up the renewables transition. I'm David Spears. Welcome to Insiders. Better outcomes for the environment, faster approval decisions for projects. That's the promise of new environment laws introduced to Parliament this week. The problem for the government, both the Greens and the Coalition remain unconvinced. We'll hear from the Environment Minister this morning on where he's willing to give ground. For the opposition, it's net zero crunch time. Nationals MPs are gathering here in Canberra as we go to air. They're set to dump the target and instead peg Australia's efforts to what the rest of the world is doing. Liberals are clinging to hope they can land a compromise position that avoids a coalition breakup. It follows a week in which higher energy prices were blamed for driving up inflation and threatening the future of Australia's biggest aluminium smelter.
A shock leap in inflation has crushed hopes for
an interest rate cut on Melbourne Cup Day.
The odds are relief for mortgage holders won't come until sometime next year.
A lot of Australians are still under pressure.
Headline inflation at 3.2%.
The Reserve Bank will be very alarmed by these numbers.
This means no relief for households, no relief when seeing the doctor.
High electricity prices are mostly to blame.
Up an average of 9%.
Largely as a result of the end of state energy rebates.
And with the federal government's own $300 a year household power rebate set to expire in December.
There'll be some temptation to extend those rebates.
But people shouldn't expect them to continue forever.
The future of the nation's largest aluminium maker hangs in the balance.
After Rio Tinto declared its New South Wales aluminium smelter is untenable.
The energy price is a defining challenge for us.
I am determined to exhaust every opportunity to secure the future of that site.
But if Tomago does survive, the bottom line is taxpayers will almost certainly be on the hook.
This is a government that is not afraid to intervene in the interests of Australian manufacturing.
A government ownership of assets is not the answer.
Morning, everyone. How are you?
The opposition is trying to thrash out its climate policy
before they reach a final position on a commitment to net zero.
There was a hell of a lot that we were united on.
This coalition has net zero credibility.
Our energy policy is about much more than the net zero target.
They are divided, they are divisive, and they are in disarray.
All those in favour say aye.
Aye.
The Nationals Federal Council passing a motion to abandon support for achieving net zero emissions.
We'll peg ourselves to the rest of the world, not streak ahead of them, but stick with them.
The federal government has introduced its Environment Protection Reform Bill.
It's now or never.
The overhaul aims for both tougher nature safeguards and swift approvals for houses and businesses.
And clarifying which areas are up for development and which are not.
Perish the thought, if they wanted to mine Uluru, they'll get a pretty quick no.
But to get it moving, it needs to win over either the Greens or the Coalition.
Labor's seven bills of EPBC reform as they are at the moment are unworkable.
I won't be rubber stamping anything that fast-tracks destruction.
What we are looking for at the end of the day is a package that delivers a net benefit for business.
As they stand, these bills fail nature.
No one is going to get 100% of what they want. We've got one shot at this. It really is now or never. Thank you.
And my guest this morning is Environment Minister Murray Watt. First, let's check what's making news. The Nationals' move to dump net zero is the main political news this morning. The party's federal council voted yesterday to remove the net zero mandate from their policy platform. Nationals MPs are gathering right now and are expected to endorse a position to drop net zero in favour of reducing emissions only in line with global action. It appears this won't be enough to satisfy Barnaby Joyce, though. The former Nationals leader is concerned renewables projects will continue in regional areas. He's now adopted a tougher position, telling me last night any proposed or current power precinct should require a vote of approval from the relevant local government authority to proceed. In the Nine newspapers, the Prime Minister's joined Asia-Pacific leaders in calling for a resilient trading system in a signal to the US and China to reach a ceasefire in their trade war. He's also spoken to my colleague Steffi Boris before leaving the APEC summit about China's dominance in the rare earths market.
We support trade. What we don't support is dominance by any one nation, because that can cause disruption in the way that markets operate.
And the Financial Review reports the Prime Minister has written to Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan in a last-ditch effort to resolve the impasse over who should host next year's global climate summit. The two countries have been in a standoff for months, and if neither side pulls out, the COP meeting will default to the German city of Bonn. Well, tomorrow marks 6 months since the Liberals' worst election defeat. The party is still trying to resolve its biggest headache, where to land on net zero. The Nationals are done waiting. Their move to dump the target in favour of only lowering emissions in line with the rest of the world, including developing countries, means a much slower pace of action. This puts considerably more pressure on Susan Lee. Liberals are nervous about what this week will bring. Let's see what the panel makes of it. We're joined by Claire Armstrong, Paul Sakal and Katina Curtis. Very good morning to all of you. So this National Party meeting's beginning right now, Claire, and it's expected that they dump net zero and instead say, we'll peg what Australia's doing, we should peg what Australia's doing to the rest of the world, global action on reducing emissions. Is that where they're going to land, do you think, this morning?
Well, that seems to be the signals that the Nationals are sending before that meeting. Of course, anything can happen in the room, but if you look at the trajectory here from some of the state-based conferences, where in particular Queensland, basically the same motion was moved to drop the mandate for net zero. It was supported yesterday in the Federal Council, so the idea that the parliamentary party room wouldn't follow that, I think, is... I think we can assume that that's what's going to happen. There may be some language used to give the Liberals a little bit of leeway. They're still a fair way from settling their position on net zero, but at this point that may not even matter. It's a pretty big mess.
And I'll show you the language used by David Littleproud after yesterday's Federal Council decision to dump net zero, the net zero mandate from the policy platform. Here's what he said.
Governments around the world are starting to become honest with their communities about the fact that getting targets net zero by 2050 and all the way along haven't been achieved and don't look to be achieved. The low-hanging fruit's been done. And the world is slowing in terms of reaching its targets and setting new targets. And so why would we streak ahead?
Why would we streak ahead of the rest of the world? Paul, what do you think? David Littleproud's not going to walk out of his own party room meeting today sticking with net zero, is he?
Yeah, it's actually... I think it's pretty precarious. I think what happens in that room in the next hour is a bit hard to predict. I think there are two worlds that could emerge out of this. David Littleproud and Ross Cadell are on the more moderate side of this debate internally in the Nats. I think they would be happy to see a Nationals position that calls to remove the mandate but allows the Liberals to have a kind of looser aspiration and gives them a bit of breathing room. There are others in the Nationals party room, led by Bridget McKenzie and Matt Canavan, who don't want any kind of net zero terminology anywhere near the energy policy of the coalition, and they would be happy to see the party split again over this, as they split about 6 months ago. In the former situation, Susan Lee doesn't need to rush to this. They can come together with the Nats and work together with, on something over time. In the latter position, there is something that's irreconcilable, and when this does get to shadow cabinet, which may not be soon, there may be a rupture.
Yeah, it feels like, you know, clearly this is all coming to a head. Katina, what's your sense of it? Well, I mean, David Littleproud might have a more moderate view about, you know, keen to find a position that can work with the Libs and avoid the blow-up and the break-up of the coalition again, but he's going to follow where his party goes today.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, I've basically thought from the moment that they appointed Matt Canavan to lead this work on what do we do about net zero, like the outcome seemed like a fait accompli, right? It's, you know, he's been for years an outspoken critic of this. It does really seem, you know, the Nationals almost following the same playbook here as they did with The Voice, like really getting ahead of the other party in the coalition and put setting out their position first, and then I guess hoping that they can drag the Liberals along with them if that's where it lands in the end.
And I mean, we might have all been reading the tea leaves and seeing clearly this is where the Nats are heading to, but I wonder if this took the Libs a little bit by surprise, the timing here, because Friday afternoon
or Friday lunchtime, Dan Tehan, you know, he held that meeting of, 25 or so Liberals to talk about their position, the ongoing chats that they're having around where are we going to land on this, and he came out of it pretty confident, Dan Tehan, that they could find some sort of unified position.
There is a pathway, I think, to bring us all together in a way that unifies us all. Now, exactly, exactly what that looks like, we are still working through it.
He didn't say net zero in that press conference, though. Yeah, he didn't say those words.
Were the Libs blindsided here, though, Claire?
I think so. It became sort of obvious late on Friday that the Nationals were intending to do a little bit more than just have a motion at their federal council. The Liberals knew that motion was coming. They were pretty relaxed at the prospect of it coming. A Liberal told me, you know, it's the membership, it's them dealing with their members. We're more concerned about what happens in the parliamentary party. And then within hours, essentially, that hope was dashed. That meeting that the Liberals had, which was attended by more than half of the Liberal Party room, it was agreement that there should be emissions reductions in some form. It was agreement that price should be a factor, and also that they didn't want to keep falling into what some were calling this trap that they feel Labor is setting by essentially forcing them to either look like there's division or to be stuck in a, like, this target or that target debate, when really, as we'll probably get to later talking about some of the issues going on this week, Labor's not in a great spot with its energy policy. There are a lot of problems.
It's not been a great week.
And for as long as you're talking about your target, you're not talking about that. The issue here is all of the coalition seems to agree that net zero is just about language and that it's a target and it doesn't mean anything, which makes it all the more confusing why they are so obsessed with getting rid of it for the sake of what they say is essentially an aspirational target. Having a target doesn't mean you're going to get there.
What else? Sorry to interrupt you.
No.
What else emerged in that meeting, and people had suspected this for a while, is that Angus Taylor, who's kind of the leader of the right, is not arguing internally to dump net zero. Mm-hmm. So you've got Angus Taylor, John O'Donoghue, Michaela Cash, James Patterson, the leadership of the right, are not pushing a hardline anti-net zero position. Mm. But there's a small but significant and well-argued group of right-wing backbenchers led by Ben Small, Garth Hamilton, Tony Passan and others.
Andrew Hastie,
who was in Perth getting a surgery consultation on his jiu-jitsu injury.
He sent out a photo of himself doing jiu-jitsu
Exactly. These right-wingers say that in these meetings, your Tim Wilsons and Andrew Braggs and others acknowledge that net zero will never be reached. Mm. They know it's, in their view, rubbish, but they say they need to keep it for political purposes to keep their seats. These right-wing backbenchers say, we need to be authentic, enough of the speaking out of both sides of our mouth, let's be real, Liberals only win when we're authentic and when we create battle lines. So that's the split.
Do they have a point, at least, in saying if they end up in this halfway house, if it's an aspiration but not a target, maybe we get there, that they're pleasing neither side?
Absolutely.
Yeah, a Liberal said to me, what is the 8-second soundbite when Susan Lee gets asked, do you support net zero? And if it's yes but or no but, you've instantly alienated both sides of
those
this
who want net zero and
debate.
Those who don't.
Yeah. I think there is genuinely quite a division and a split forming in the right faction of the Liberals over this. Andrew Hastie, I hate to reference this, but he posted a meme early at the end of the week, which was essentially indicating that Libs putting net zero language into their policy platform was the equivalent of putting a stick into the spoke of your bicycle. but interestingly, he also kind of made a reference to those Liberals then blaming shifting to a Farage-light version of, populism of the right, which that's exactly the language that James Patterson used in a speech. So that's an interesting...
So just quickly before we move on, if the Nats come out of this in the next hour or so and say, that's it, net zero's gone, we're now going to just do what the rest of the world is doing, which, by the way, I think by 2050 the estimates are would only be a 40% emissions reduction, maybe even only a 25% emissions reduction. Either way, a lot less. How does Susan Lee go this week? There's a lot of nervousness amongst Liberals. I was contacting last night. This is going to be potentially a diabolical week ahead. Is that the feeling?
Yeah, yeah. It's not going to go well for her at all. I mean, even with Angus Taylor, her kind of leader rival there, very much saying that dropping net zero is not the way to go. Whatever momentum they thought they might have been able to get out of building some consensus around principles on Friday is completely dashed by the last 48 hours.
And they're trying to really reframe the debate, want to reframe the debate around energy prices, but that internal division really undercuts it. It just means that every time they ask Chris Bowen a question about energy prices, he just gets up and whacks them about, you don't believe in climate change. So it's, you know, that's a problem for them. And I think there's also a bit of wishy-washiness in understanding of the net zero language. I got a press release from a Liberal this week. The headline was, "Bomb delivers net zero benefits," was about the Bureau of Meteorology's website. Like, that makes no sense at all, just in a sort of general English language way.
All right. There's talk that and Susan Lee has said this to someone, that they might accelerate their own policy to the middle of next week in response to the NAT.
Yeah,
so the next few days, it's very fluid. There's a chance that the doomsday scenario just doesn't play out and the Nats give the Libs some room, and that it takes a few weeks or months and they announce a shadow cabinet policy in the dead of December. So that's the Pollyanna-ish view, but it could all go pear-shaped.
We will see. Time to talk to Environment Minister Murray Watt. Now, he's trying to overhaul environment laws to speed up decisions on projects, including those that are critical to the net zero transition. Now, under the law, if a project is deemed too damaging to the environment, the minister could still approve it on national interest grounds, including defence or national security. But some are concerned this power is too broad, including Ken Henry, the former Treasury Secretary, who I spoke to for the podcast this week. He's now the chair of the Australian Climate and Biodiversity Foundation.
In my mind, it wouldn't be enough to establish that there is a relationship to defence. You know, I mean...
it's too broad?
It's too broad. Yeah, right. I mean, I would think that if we're talking about matters affecting national security, you're talking about the threat of imminent attack or something of that nature, something with that gravity. You're not just talking about building more kit for defence.
It sounds like you think it needs to be a bit more specific.
I think so, yeah.
Murray Watt, welcome to the program.
G'day, David.
So are you willing to be more specific about when the minister of the day can use this national interest power to approve a project that's damaging to the environment?
Well, what we're seeking to do here, David, is to achieve a balanced package of reforms that do deliver real gains for the environment and for business. It's 5 years to the week that Graham Samuel released his blueprint outlining that sort of balanced package, and that's what we're delivering. So I'm open to hearing from all sorts of parties about what sort of changes they would require in order to support this bill. You know, at the end of the day, what I want to make sure of is that the package of reforms that we do pass through the Parliament, and I'm very confident that we will, do achieve that balance. If that requires some tweaks here or there, then I'm obviously open to hearing from people, but that's the overarching goal that we're seeking.
Well, your colleague Madeleine King, the Resources Minister, says the Minister could use this power to approve a rare earths mine. Is that right?
Well, the way the legislation is designed, and again, like most of this legislation, it very faithfully repeats the recommendations from Graham Samuel's review. He was on the ABC himself on Friday saying that this bill very much replicates his recommendations. He recommended that in rare instances, a minister should have the ability to approve a project even if it doesn't meet the usual environmental standards in the national interest. Now, what the legislation does is point to things like defence and security projects. In theory, it could be used to approve a critical minerals mine if that was deemed by the minister to be in the national interest. But that would be after a full environmental assessment. The requirement of the legislation is that that project be limited in every way possible to avoid breaching those national standards. But ultimately, as Graham Samuel said, we believe that a minister in an elected government should, in rare circumstances, have the ability to approve a project that is in the national interest.
So that's a yes. If an environmental approval says, look, this rare earths mine and the processing of the minerals is going to be so damaging to the environment, it should not go ahead, the minister can still step in and say, this rare earths mine or processing is in the national interest. It will go ahead despite that damage.
Well, that will be obviously up to the Minister of the day, and it will require a full environmental assessment for that particular project. I can't sort of say that every single critical minerals mine will get a tick because, of course, the presumption is that the national environmental standards would be applied. But yes, under the legislation, if the Minister of the day decided that that particular project was in the national interest and a full environmental assessment had occurred to minimise those environmental impacts, if it was still in the national interest to proceed, then the Minister would have the ability to approve that.
What about a gas project?
Well, again, the legislation doesn't specify the types of projects that it can't be used for. Just to give you some perspective
So it could be a gas project?
Well, again, what the legislation points to is projects that relate to defence and security or national emergencies.
And this is the point. It's pretty broad. The criticism is it's too broad. You're not willing to put any more clarity around that. So, in theory, it could include anything.
Well, and again, I'm open to hearing from people about what they think should be tweaked with this legislation in order to pass it. But as I was saying, David, just to give you some perspective, the current legislation that we're seeking to reform has the ability for a minister to grant a national interest exemption from the Act, which is an exemption from the entire Act, much further than the approval we're talking about. That's been used around 27 times so far. 17 of them have been for natural disasters or to help regenerate species that are at risk of extinction. So they're the kind of things that it's typically used for, and I think they're a pretty good guide.
You also want to speed up decisions by making it very clear from the outset when a project can't go ahead if it's got an unacceptable impact. But again, there's a concern, there's not much clarity here. What is an unacceptable impact that would stop a project in its tracks?
Well, I guess I would argue, David, that there's much more clarity included in the reforms that we're putting forward than exist under the current legislation. Under the current legislation, a minister can knock back a project if it's going to be clearly unacceptable, but there's no definition of what that means in the current legislation. What we're seeking to do through these reforms is actually provide a definition of what would be considered an unacceptable impact on the environment and would therefore get a no. And the sorts of things that we're talking about in that definition are, for example, if something was going to seriously impair or have irreplaceable damage to a particular environmental matter. And some of the examples I've given have been if, perish the thought, someone wanted to mine Uluru, drill on the Great Barrier Reef, drive a species to extinction. I think most Australians would say that that kind of project shouldn't proceed.
So, I mean, mining Uluru sounds pretty extreme, but on driving a species to extinction. So if something was going to, for example, wipe out the Maugean skate in Tasmania, that would be unacceptable.
If there was conclusive evidence that a particular project was going to drive a species to extinction, then without wanting to prejudge a future decision, I think it's likely that a minister would knock that back. Of course, with the Maugean skate, we are undertaking a lot of work to regenerate that species, oxygenation of the water there, captive breeding programs, which are actually starting to see that species recover a bit. But yeah, I mean, if a particular project is going to drive a species to extinction or have an irreplaceable impact on it or a particular environment, then it would be likely to get a no. And I might say, David, this also, obviously there's an environmental benefit there, but it also responds to the request from business that they want quick yeses and quick noes. This is a way that business can get a quick no and understand that they really shouldn't bother putting up a project and racking up the millions of dollars in costs because it's very likely going to be a no.
It might be faster, but is any environmental damage going to be prevented under this new law than that is currently not prevented under the current law?
Absolutely. The laws that we're putting forward contain a range of measures that shift the dial in favour of preserving nature forevermore. So, for example, for the first time, we'll have national environmental standards that will set out clear criteria for decision makers to use when they're determining environmental impacts. We're reforming environmental offsets, which everyone regards as a bit of a joke at the moment, to require for the first time in law that a proponent would need to avoid or mitigate or minimise the environmental impact of a project before offsetting it. And if they do turn to offsets, then they've got to deliver a net gain for the environment. So that's part of what Graham Samuel was talking about, that we shouldn't just be managing the decline of the environment, we should actually be seeking to restore the environment as well. So much bigger penalties for those who breach our environmental laws and engage in illegal clearing and that kind of thing. So a number of things that will lead to an improvement for nature, not just see it ongoing decline.
Part of your effort to speed up the whole decision-making process is you want to end the overlap of federal and state approvals. What would this mean for a decision on whether, for example, to approve development of Australia's largest untapped gas reserve, the Browse Basin, off Western Australia? Who would make that decision?
So I'll come to the specific example in a minute, David, but as I say, just to explain that, one of the big barriers we've got to developments happening, whether it be housing, renewables, other projects at the moment, is that proponents need to go through both a state assessment and approval and a federal assessment and approval, and that can add years to the whole process. So one of the ways that we want to overcome that is by entering into agreements with a state, which would allow them to do the assessment not just on their own behalf against their own laws, but also against our laws, but with those really tight safeguards, such as that the decision needs to meet our national standards. The processes that a state government has in place would need to be accredited and audited by the federal government to prevent a state going rogue. So there are those safeguards in place. When it comes to the Browse project specifically, that would not be able to proceed through a bilateral agreement because it's already determined to be a controlled action. Right. That project was lodged years ago with the federal government. It reached the stage of being decided to be what's known as a controlled action, meaning that it requires a full EBBC assessment. So because it's a project that's effectively in the system now, it would continue to be assessed under the current laws.
Okay.
The change would be for future projects.
Bottom line, is there anything in this new legislation to stop a coal or a gas project going ahead?
Not in its own right. What we haven't taken the approach of saying that particular projects are altogether banned. Every project will be assessed on its merits, whether it be a coal and gas project, whether it be a housing and renewable project. They've all got to demonstrate that they're not having a significant impact on one of the nine matters of national environmental significance under the Act.
But for coal and gas, for fossil fuel projects, does the new law make it any harder to get an approval?
I wouldn't say that it alters the sort of whether a project can or can't go ahead. As I say, what it does is put together criteria that need to be used when deciding whether the project goes ahead. If a coal or gas mine was to be, a coal or gas development was seeking approval, then it would need to meet the national environmental standards. It would need to avoid and minimise its environmental impacts and offset them to achieve a net gain. So they would be improvements compared to the criteria that apply to a project at the moment. If it was considered to have an unacceptable impact on the environment, then it would get knocked back, as would a housing development or a renewable project. So we're not trying to sort of put in particular criteria for particular sectors. What we're trying to do is put in a balanced package for all sorts of projects, for all industries that deliver environmental and business gains.
The bill doesn't put an end to native forest logging either. Do you want native forest logging to continue?
Well, our government doesn't have a policy of ending native forestry in the way that the Greens Party is seeking. What we have said, though, is that we will follow the recommendation from Graham Samuel to apply national environmental standards to the regional forestry agreements that are used for native forestry. So what that means in practice is that native forestry would need to meet higher environmental standards than are currently required under the legislation. That's a big step forward in terms of the environmental management of native forestry, but it doesn't go as far as what the Greens Party is seeking in being an all-out ban.
So native forest logging at the end of the day could continue. How's that going to help the environment?
Well, it could continue, but only if it meets those new national environmental standards, and that's something that's not required at the moment. The RFAs that native forestry occurs under at the moment follow environmental standards that are typically set by state governments. I think most observers would agree that they're probably not as strong as the national environmental standards that we're looking to introduce will be. So that would lift the requirements when it comes to environmental management, and I think that'd have a positive outcome for threatened species.
But leaving them unlogged would be a better outcome for the environment, wouldn't it?
Some would argue that, David.
What do you think? You're the minister.
Yeah, but I mean, as I say, we're not arguing for an all-out ban on native forestry. I mean, leaving aside the jobs and the economic potential, matters involving native forestry. Also, there are a range of products that Australians depend upon that rely on native forestry. So we're not going as far as banning it altogether, but we do want to see a much stronger environmental outcome than what we see at the moment.
So you need either the Greens or the Coalition to pass this. You want to get it done by the end of the year. I'm not sure how likely that's looking, but let me ask you what ground you're willing to give. Are you willing to drop plans for an EPA altogether to win the Coalition support?
We wouldn't be prepared to go that far, David. I suspect with your list of questions that is no doubt coming at me, I'll be mostly saying I'm not ruling things in or out. But there's no way that Labor will drop the creation of a new EPA. That is something that we've taken to two elections explicitly and has been endorsed by the Australian people. So we think it's a really important measure to really lift the compliance and enforcement of nature in Australia. I think it will be a real legacy for the Albanese government in the same way that saving Kakadu, stopping mining on Antarctica was for the Hawke government as well.
What about the Coalition demand, though, that the minister should be able to sack the boss of the EPA?
Look, I mean, as I say, we haven't sort of made final decisions about where we're prepared to go. I mean, I do think that it is important that a national EPA has a high degree of independence from the government of the day. That's why, for example, we've specified that when it comes to who they prosecute, who they investigate, what sort of fines they dish out for environmental damage, that should be independent of ministers. We don't allow ministers to tell the DPP who they can prosecute for murder or assault. We leave that to an independent DPP, and it's a similar principle.
It sounds like a bit more room, though, on that one. And on the Greens, you've said absolutely no to a climate trigger, which they've been asking for, but are you willing to shift on the issue of native forest logging?
Well, as I say, David, we're open, well, not just open, we've committed to apply the national environmental standards to our regional forestry agreements.
But we haven't seen those standards. We won't see those until after the law has passed, will we?
Actually, two of the standards, being the two that stakeholders most wanted to see around matters of national environmental significance and offsets, we expect to be producing them in the next few days for people to see. The intention is not to develop a standard for native forestry, but to apply the standards as a whole to native forestry. And frankly, I haven't heard a single stakeholder who wants a particular standard for native forestry. So some of those standards will be coming in the next couple of days, even though they can't be created until after this bill is passed. But yeah, there's room to move on native forestry insofar as we have said that we'll apply those standards to the RFAs.
Let me move to the news of the day around the Nationals expecting to drop formally their commitment to a net zero target by 2050, and instead say Australia should lower emissions in line with the rest of the world. What do you think about this? Are you concerned that this could further shift public opinion when it comes to the net zero target?
I just think that yet again we're seeing the tail wagging the dog in the coalition. We've got the National Party, which didn't even rate 4% of the vote in the last federal election, dictating terms to the Liberal Party, who claim to be the majority party in a coalition. It's a repeat of what we saw with nuclear, David, where the National Party went out first to drag the Liberal Party into supporting nuclear, only to be resoundingly rejected by the Australian people at the last election. I mean, the idea that you would hand over climate and energy policy to the likes of Matt Canavan and the ghost of Barnaby Joyce is like handing Dracula the keys to the blood bank. Half the National Party don't believe in climate change. The other half just want to wish it away. What they are doing in dragging the Liberal Party to this position is getting in the way of the incredible economic opportunity that transitioning to net zero provides. So it's a real test for the Liberal Party about whether they're going to continue being dictated to by a junior partner in their coalition who doesn't believe in climate change, or whether they're going to get with the rest of the world and take the economic opportunities that transition involves.
Minister, there are difficulties in the transition, as you know, and this week the coalition's been pointing to Tomago, the aluminium smelter threatening to close down, the inflation figures driven by an energy price. You know, prices are still going up for our power bills. What do you say to those who say, why should Australia be moving faster than the rest of the world on cutting emissions?
What I can say is that any credible economist can show you that the longer we take to get to net zero and the more we delay, the higher the cost will be. And that's why we are so committed to pursuing this transition and getting on with it. I mean, to take the Tomago example this week, that is a tragedy that over 1,000 workers are potentially at risk of losing their jobs. What the owners of Tomago have said is that the reason they're looking at potentially closing that is because they can't get access to the cheap renewable power that they need. need. The same company owns a smelter in Gladstone. That is not at risk of closing because they've been able to access the cheaper renewable power that they need. They can't get it for Tomago. So there's an example just this week that shows we need more renewable energy, not less. And, of course, that's one of the things we're seeking to achieve through those EPBC reforms as well.
Finally, Minister, the Bureau of Meteorology, their website update didn't go down well this week. You called on them to fix it. It sounds like they have made some changes. I think it's more than $80 million spent on this website upgrade. Is that taxpayers' money well spent?
Look, I think it is really important that taxpayers and all Australians have access to reliable information from what is a great Australian institution in the Bureau of Meteorology. I did have a meeting with the acting CEO of the BOM this week, and I made the point that I didn't think the new website was meeting users' expectations. So I was really pleased to see that on Friday they began making some changes, in particular going back to the previous default view on the radar, which enables people to see hail and things like that. That proved very useful here in southeast Queensland yesterday when we had another severe thunderstorm and it provided people with that information. But, you know, I'm very pleased that the BOM has listened to community feedback. I know they've got plans to make more changes. That's what we want. But we also want a really credible, reliable service as well.
Environment Minister Murray Watt, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, David.
Coming up, we'll get to that jump in inflation, plus the longest question time ever in the Senate and politicians' T-shirts. Let's get back to our panel, though. We're joined by Claire Armstrong, Paul Sakal and Katina Curtis. Claire, just on the environment laws, Murray Watt, they're clearly opening up a couple of fronts on the Greens side and the Coalition side where he might be willing to negotiate.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's very obvious that the government wants to get this done by Christmas. Anthony Albanese has said as much. He set his fixer, Murray Watt, onto the task. But the issue Labor have is, even though to the letter of the bill, it's probably a lot more appealing to that sort of centrist thing that the Coalition might go for. The Coalition, as we've sort of canvassed, are internally in disarray. The prospect of getting a bill that's controversial like this through that shadow cabinet at the moment is pretty slim. It's, you know, even worse that it's environment and it has that kind of net zero adjacent component. So that does put the Greens in the hot seat, but they are much further away, I think, from feeling like they're able to make a deal.
So I think, I mean, I understand that the Greens are what they're actually asking for behind closed doors. It's been put to me that it's a small number of big things. So and the rhetoric is less strident, as you'd probably expect, than Larissa Waters has been out there this week saying, oh, the minister let the logging companies and the miners in the room to write this, gave them the pen, they wrote these laws. Like, you know, they're much more moderated.
Overheated Greens rhetoric, no.
But I think that really, as you say, yeah, they're much closer with the Coalition. The Coalition demands are a bit more in line with where a lot of the industry lobby groups are at. The question about what happens with the EPA and the power of that, that's more of a sort of niche Liberals only request. But the risk on that side is entirely they might reach a deal with Angie Bell and Susan Lee, but will the party room actually get on board? That's a not insignificant risk
as to
where we go.
Well, I mean, we just heard the minister there say there's nothing here that's going to stop coal and gas mines. Projects can get approved more speedily. Maybe they're willing to give the Libs this power over the EPA so that the boss can be sacked by the minister. If this lines up as exactly what gives the Coalition something, gives them a win, is Susan Lee in a political position to do a deal with the government on this?
Not until she fixes the net zero problem.
It's all hung up.
But I don't, even if they do come to some, you know, flimsy but workable solution on net zero in the next few weeks, it's not going away as an issue for her.
Mm.
So she'll come into the first part of next year wanting to move on to economic stuff. She won't want another fight on environmental issues at all. So I think probably not. Just an interesting theme in this debate, and it's something that splits the Labor kind of centrist position on the environment from the Greens and the Teals and some of the transparency groups and climate groups, is this idea of ministerial and executive power over decision-making. If you spoke to David Pocock and the Greens and others, they want an EPA to make all the decisions here and for all of this to be taken out of government's hands. I think there is a persuasive argument that Murray Watt makes around the government's elected. Mm. It has constituencies on its left, including its backbench, which wants pro-Green outcomes. And ministers are elected and they're accountable to us as voters. So it's an interesting theme that often comes up in Greens and Teals criticism of the government that's playing out here.
End of the day, this ministerial intervention
power, right? So projects are put up and the decision is, no, it's no good for the environment, but the minister can still step in and approve it.
Yeah.
He's basically confirmed what Madeleine King said the other day, on rare earths mines, that it can be used for rare earths mines.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the justification of, you know, defence or national security, national interest test, I mean, we've seen in the last few weeks the government saying they need to change the FOI laws for national security reasons. Like, it can be
pretty broad.
If needed be. And I really think that, Madeleine King perhaps, talking to people from Canada where she's over there, talking critical minerals financing with the Canadians, needs to reassure our international partners on this.
Anthony Albanese's best bud, Donald Trump.
That's right. And just on the sort of the resources aspect of this, Roger Cook's actually coming to Canberra with Rita Saffiotti, his treasurer, this week for a few days.
Yep.
High on their list of meetings is one with Murray Watt. So, he was away on holidays last week, on leave, Roger Cook was, but, he's had a good look at the bill. He still has concerns with it, and he'll be talking to the minister.
What's interesting for me about this bill as well, if you set aside the actual mechanics of what the proposal is there's this whole political aspect happening to one side. Labor have mobilised their caucus. They're going out into electorates. They're door knocking. They have an autofill website that they're encouraging people to send a note to your senator to say, I want an EPA. And when you look at what, everyone always says that Anthony Albanese is probably already thinking about a 95-seat strategy for 2028.
No doubt.
When you look at what the Labor Party were able to do in terms of inoculating themselves against the Greens in inner city seats, the fact they'll probably be under pressure from Teal-style challengers in a lot of seats next time. It's fascinating to me. They've got a backbench that are of the left. The left control the Labor caucus for the first time ever.
Yeah.
They're insistent that this thing not get watered down. They were the ones demanding answers for why there isn't a climate trigger in the bill, almost just as much as the Greens. So the political play happening here
That's a good point. That political campaign and Murray Watt's rhetoric there does rub up against the fact that there is a global shift in the green energy transition. If you listen to Murray Watt, there's this global lust for the renewables transition. And yes, that is where we're heading. But Bill Gates, Tony Blair, every week there's a new public figure who says, maybe we need to slow down here.
Mm.
The rubber hasn't hit the road quite yet in Australia, though Tomago is a great canary.
Well, let's move on to some of these things. I mean, inflation, firstly. Take a look at the figures this week. Inflation, you can see the post-COVID spike there. The headline is the yellow line and the underlying rate is the red line. They spiked after COVID. Inflation then came down. Great news. It's back within that Reserve Bank target range of 2 to 3%. But then what did we see this week? What you can see right at the on the far right there, that tick up in inflation, both headline and underlying. And a lot of that, not all of it, but a lot of it did have to do with energy prices. So how concerning is this for the government?
This is bad, bad news for the government. And if where there was a sort of functioning opposition at the moment, the Labor Party would be the majority of the conversation of this episode because they have a huge problem with household electricity prices, with the way that industry has now really come to the fore and said, the fact that Rio Tinto, we're getting to Tomago in a minute, don't necessarily want just a bailout because they're saying this is a longer-term problem about the availability of energy, the cost of energy. This is the ball game for this term of government.
And we'll get to Tomago, but the immediate question for the government is what do they do with the household energy rebate? They've kept extending it. It's worth $300 a year. All households get it. They extended it again in the May budget until the end of this year. And back in May, inflation was actually lower than it is now. Power prices lower than they are now. So arguably, if the Treasurer's argument that this is a cost of living measure, that would certainly hold now. But as Ken Henry says, you can't keep this thing going forever.
If you have to provide a permanent or semi-permanent rebate for something, then you're saying that your policy settings are wrong. Your energy policy settings are wrong.
Yeah, Jim Chalmers says it's not going to be permanent, but no decision, it sounds, has been made on whether it goes beyond the end of this year just yet.
Those energy rebates won't be in the budget forever. At some point, they will taper away. We've made it clear on multiple occasions now and for some time since the budget that we will review those energy rebates from budget update to budget update. That remains the case.
What do you reckon they do?
I think it is interesting he's saying they'll taper away, which maybe suggests they could extend them, but, as you know, only $50 instead of $100, $150 perhaps. And I mean, a lot of what we saw in the inflation figures this week were also the state governments are ending their energy rebates. Most of them aren't in a position financially to keep them going on.
Yeah, it's bad policy. I don't think the government wants to keep it going, and inflation's nowhere near what it was when we put those rebates on. I think what this does show, though, is that the idea of this term was that Chalmers has dealt with the inflation crisis, we move into a second term with a big majority and he can deal with the structural issues in a more benign economic environment where he has space to do big reform. He had his reform roundtable, we hear almost nothing about it. He had the super tax blow up with the Prime Minister. So he's on the mat a little bit. He's trying to get up and then all of a sudden inflation's no good. And the RBA, what this does show as well, the inflation figure, is that we aren't able to run as an economy with as quick growth as we used to because of the productivity problem.
Yeah.
So these things are all tied and it's unclear where they go next on the economy, but we don't know much about how they're going to fix it.
Well, we know we probably won't get a rate cut this year. But the next one, some say, depending on the figures, might be in the other direction. Let's talk about Tomago, because Australia's largest aluminium smelter is now threatened to close. Can't find cheap power, it says, beyond 2028 when its current contract comes to an end. It's consulting its 1,000-odd workforce, which is a real worry. There's a four-week consultation now with the government on what they can do. Clearly, they don't want to just keep bailing out. Rio Tinto is the majority owner here. But we've seen a trend from the government this year with bailouts, essentially. So what are they looking at on this one?
It seems like one of the key things here is that the federal government really wants to keep Rio and the New South Wales government at the table talking, trying to sort out this power thing. The federal government points out that because Rio Tinto also has another smelter up in Queensland that is not in the same position
this
as this,
the Boyne
one, and they've been busy in Queensland over the last couple of years pouring money into large-scale renewables.
To feed the smelter.
And the Queensland government, both the Labor government and Chris Afulli, you know, he went through that thing where he's like, we're going to put all these renewables projects on ice. Rio Tinto got in and was like, excuse me.
And
you know, he's backed them in as well. Whereas they haven't been able to get that scale of investment happening in New South Wales. And that seems to be the key thing here. Rio was saying this week, like, basically, any power deal, any future deal for getting energy that involves coal power is just non-commercial. Like, it's too expensive. So they don't want coal, renewables.
Rio as a company is committed to getting out of fossil fuels, I think, by 2035. So they don't want to be entering new long-term coal deals. One idea that's been put forward from Oliver Yates, former head of the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, is because renewable prices can be so volatile, the government would use a special vehicle to buy the power, then provide it at a stable price to Tomago. It could have a downside, it could have an upside for taxpayers. But there are various ideas like that, instead of just giving them a check.
The view inside the government is that the New South Wales state government, which is Labor, is less interested in taking an interventionist approach than the Queensland government, which is, I think, is not a... The Queensland government's conservative, but there's more of a culture of interventionism in the energy market in Queensland. And the view inside the government also is that no matter what deal gets done here, unless it's extraordinary and Chris Minns suddenly comes to the table with heaps of cash, that Rio's out. They are. This is not going anywhere. It's done.
The problem being that once the government has opted for intervention, once it becomes, where do you draw the line on stopping?
Everyone's got their hand out.
When we've seen a whole string of these, and the government has asked, I was thinking back to the BHP shuttering Nickel West and the Associated Refinery a year ago, which is in Madeleine King's electorate, and she gave them a big whack, basically saying at the time, well, you know, we're seeing all of these massive companies choosing to give cash to their shareholders instead of putting the investment into the ageing facilities and that would keep them running.
We've got to move on because the clock's going to beat us, and there's two issues I just want to get on too quickly. The longest question time in the Senate ever went for, what, 3.5 hours. Yeah. What was that all about?
I lasted an hour and a half, and
well
then I
you.
Had to go do other things. But I was sort of keeping an eye on it on my phone. This is an issue that has been brewing for a long time, despite what Labor are trying to claim that it's come out of nowhere. Transparency. There is a growing view among the crossbench, the opposition, and I would argue the media, that not only is this government not as transparent as they could be, they are far from what they promised coming into government in 2022. to be even, you know, better on transparency. Things like production of documents, appearing before, or resisting and mucking around with inquiries, responding to questions on notice, responding to FOIs, all of that has built up. One thing in particular is this thing called the Briggs Review. It was something that Labor did in the early heady days of their election where they're all about transparency. Let's look at how we deal with jobs for the boys on boards. Mm. They've now been sitting on that review for years. It obviously is not what they want to release. So the crossbench kind of coordinated out of Pocock's office with the opposition and the Greens to compel the compel the government to release this report by essentially saying, we're going to keep question time going. We're going to give five or so more questions to the opposition and crossbench until such a time as you release the Briggs Review. What ensued was 3.5 hours of parliamentary nonsense, to be honest.
Yeah, we'll see if they do any better this week. And finally, T-shirt gate. Susan Lee used a parliamentary speech to rip into the Prime Minister for wearing the Joy Division T-shirt when he stepped off the plane. The band's name originated from a sexual slavery wing of a Nazi concentration camp. Pretty well-known band, though, been around a long time, very popular and so on. And not all of Susan Lee's colleagues were rushing to back her in on this one.
I don't really care what T-shirt he wears. I really don't.
Hey, look, if the Prime Minister knew about that, that's his business and his decision.
I'm not in the business of engaging in these conversations.
Look, there's a lot to legitimately criticise the Prime Minister about. Wearing a T-shirt isn't one of them.
When it comes to fashion, I don't claim to be the right person to ask.
I think Ted's selling himself short a little bit there. Paul, what happened there? That was not exactly a ringing endorsement of Susan Lee's charge on the T-shirt front.
Yeah, it's all a bit silly, but I think it actually was a pretty bad moment for her. I walked into this moment halfway through her speech just before question time and I heard her talking about Joy Division and anti-Semitism and I said, is she echoing the stuff I've been seeing on Twitter from these right-wing accounts who have been talking about this since he wore the T-shirt? And it turned out she was. It went from right-wing Twitter to Shari Markson on Sky, and then a few days later, Susan Lee in Question Time. And she's effectively arguing that the Prime Minister knew the origins of this name. The band is not supportive of Nazism.
No.
Neither is any part of its support.
This is what punk bands
punk bands in the 80s, maybe a bit lame and edgy to do that, but that is the name. And it caused the colleagues and staff to really start questioning whether the office and Susan Lee have the correct judgment.
Just quickly, it's a tough judgment. Yeah. That's what it's about.
Is this another example of having to overreach, like with calling for Kevin Rudd to be brought home, which is under pressure?
And the other one was calling for the EPBC bill to be split in two, which happened last weekend and quickly vanished as everyone said it was stupid.
I think she's conscious on the anti-Semitism issue, having sort of had this past of being on the Parliamentary Friends of Palestine group. She does tend to maybe defer to others around her a little bit and look for advice. Her office say they were having the issue raised with them by Jewish Australians. But it still comes down to how you use the platform of opposition leader and when you decide to go and when you decide to not go. And that's what's concerned her colleagues.
We've got to move on. Our panel, Katina Curtis, Paul Sakar, Claire Armstrong. Time for some final observations. Quick one from me. Anthony Albanese now has Donald Trump's mobile phone number. He's confirmed to Kieran Gilbert on Sky News before they left the APEC summit in South Korea. They swapped numbers, so their relationship status is at a new point.
Did he admit that he thought that Trump, that he said that Trump didn't have one?
Don't know if we went that far. Don't know if we went that far. Yeah.
We saw in the Federation Chamber this week, which is not watched by very many people, a string of conservative men stand up and link a bill that's supposed to be giving support to parents who have stillborns or whose babies die shortly after birth, give them some more workplace rights, entitlement to leave while they're grieving. They stood up and linked that to abortion, basically insinuating that women would have late-term abortions in order to get leave, which is just so beyond the pale that I can't even speak about it. In the aftermath of the Queensland election last year, we saw some of the Liberal Party and Jacinta Price try to reopen abortion as an issue. Peter Dutton clamped down on it very quickly. As I understand it, Susan Lee, she certainly hasn't said anything publicly on this. I understand she hasn't said anything privately to these people either.
Interesting. Paul?
One of Hastie's colleagues said to me, imagine if he was the leader and he said this, he'd have to quit, or it would just go on for weeks.
Yeah.
Just on the Liberal Party, for all the insanity that we see in Canberra, there is a really important review that's been undertaken by Senator James McGrath, which will look at whether the state divisions work, whether candidate selection is in order, how they deal with migrant communities and women, and just whether this is how you would have a functioning centre-right party if you were to build one today. It got approved at the party's federal executive on Friday. It's going to be led by James McGrath, Mike Baird, Will Hodgman, Nicole Flint, and a group of women, including Sasha Meldrum, Jane Bunkle, Fiona Cunningham, Danielle Young, Carolyn DeRusso, and Carolyn Inge. And that will report sometime in the middle of next year.
Interesting. All right, Claire.
Change of pace for me. People might have seen on social media that the member for Hunter, Dan Rapacoli, shaved his very famous beard off for good cause. He raised more than $100,000 for, I think, the RFDS Care Flight and the Mark Hughes Foundation, which does brain cancer research. So it just goes to show, you know, there are great ways to use your platform.
Yeah, that's a valuable beard. All right, thank you all very much. Terrific panel. Thanks for joining us this morning. Finally, on this program last week, Matt Canavan was raising concerns about the impact of wind farms on koalas, and even likening himself to an environmentalist wearing a koala suit. For Labor, it was simply unbearable. We'll leave you with that. Thanks for watching.
On this news, Tomago's operators said, and I quote, "We have enjoyed the benefit of affordable coal-based contracts for the last 40 years of operation."
Senator Canavan has indeed mischaracterised what the owners of that facility said. I know that you will continue to do that. I mean, how much can a koala bear?
You're making us all feel very excited about being here.